It's on Adobe, so if people would want to log on to Adobe. All right, we've got it.
Now?
Yes,
from
this
the
is it.
Yeah.
Perfect.
No, it did it on the wrong one.
It did it on the wrong screen. Okay, not perfect yet. Okay, the role of the policy development process work team, we're responsible for developing the new policy development process that incorporates both the working group approach as opposed to the old task force approach. Yes, I'm seeing hand raised. We're trying. We have some technical difficulties. We are working on that. Thank you. So the Board Governance Committee came out with a report several years ago which laid out the whole foundation for the GNSO improvement process. We've already completed the portion of the review process that deals with the structure of the council, and that's already been reformed. And if you've seen the council either at today's council meeting or before, you'll notice that they're in two houses, the contracted parties and the non-contracted parties. So that was really the first priority of what was accomplished. Now we're on to the second stage, which is the whole reformation of the policy development process. You've also seen the other element, which is the working group work team's report, the final report that was released at the end of May, which incorporates the working group approach. So I'm going to read, and the slides will get up there eventually at some point.
Let me see if there's IT.
We're working on it.
Marika, do you not have them on your machine?
Oh, I got
it. Or we can put it on your computer.
I'm leaving.
Oh, you're leaving. Okay, so I'll just keep going through it. They'll work it out. So what we did is we formed last year in February of 2009, and the approach we took, basically we were told with pretty much an open slate, your job is to look at the entire policy development process from the beginning and suggest any reforms, looking at the Board Governance Committee report on some suggestions that they had on improving the efficiencies of the policy development process, but also looking at issues of what's gone right in the past, what hasn't gone so right in the past, and what kind of approaches the council and other working groups have taken in order to accommodate some of the issues. I think this morning, for those of you that were in the GNSO council meeting, there was a reference by the GNSO chair to dealing with some of the timelines that are in the bylaws, which set really the policy development process. And, you know, the timeline said everything from an issues report needs to be generated within 15 days after the council votes to initiate the PDP or votes to initiate the process. And timelines like that, while very useful to set timelines in order to keep work focused, were rarely, if ever, met. And so in order to reflect past practices, improve the efficiencies of the policy development process, and to not just the efficiencies in terms of timelines, but in quality of information and quality of outputs. So the policy development process work team, which we abbreviate PDPWT in the tradition of having a lot of abbreviations, what we did with the breadth of this entire subject, we divided ourselves into five stages and then some overarching issues which really permeate throughout the entire process. And the next few slides will go over what those five stages are. But we've really done a lot of work in the last year and a half, or since February 2009. We've had weekly calls every single week on Thursday afternoons for us in the East Coast time, or Thursday mornings here, to discuss and address each question that's come up. And as we've also done online surveys for members of the work team on each of the different stages, and then we've recently released at the end of May an initial report that contains some draft recommendations. And if you've picked up a draft recommendation from the back, or Glenn has found you to give you one, the executive summary or the recommendations itself is 24 pages, and the entire report's probably close to 150 or so. Really a lot of stuff in here. And for those of you that heard me earlier at the GNSO Council session, this is really the key of what the GNSO does. When you boil it down, it's the development of the GNSO community as a whole. It's the development of policy and how that's done. And in fact, for the contracted parties, for the registries and registrars, this is the process by which consensus policies are created. And consensus policies are essentially amendments to the registry and registrar contracts, GTLD registry and GTLD registrar contracts. But there was always a presumption that by a number of people in the community that the policy development process is only about the development of consensus policies. Well, we're all here to tell you that that's not the case. In fact, there are a large number of outputs of a policy development process. You could have everything from what we talked about before, which is the consensus policies, or you could have, for example, a recommendation of best practices. Maybe it's just guidelines. Maybe it's a registrant bill of rights. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things in theory that could go through a policy development process. And how do we – you have control of the – okay. Thank you. We'll go to the next slide. So the goals of this session is to provide a very short overview of what's in the report and some of the new items that are in there, and really to highlight those items that we solicit your input on. There are a number of items that had – I was going to say two sides, but really in reality there could be five sides of the same issue. And, you know, as a work team, we recognize these issues. We offer possible approaches, but we didn't necessarily at this stage come to any kind of conclusion as to what the proper way of that particular element should go. So we're really pushing it out to the community to get your feedback, and also to remind you that there is a public comment period that is currently set to end on July 21st. So we really need your comments by then. I think with everything else going on, I hope I'm not being too presumptuous to say that there's a good chance that we'll probably extend that. Really, the goal is to get feedback, and so we don't want to constrain it because of the fact there's so many other reports out there that people are responding to now. So I think this is not the right slide that's up there.
No,
so
someone's changing something.
That's
I'm not sure he's doing that.
We're gonna try to get back to the right presentation here.
Right.
Okay, we're on the next slide. Yep. Okay, so the five stages we divided the PDP into were the first stage being the planning and request for an issues report, the second stage being the council review of the issues report and initiation of the policy development process. The third stage is actually where the working group's doing the work on the particular policy. And the fourth stage is voting and implementation of the policy. And finally, a look back at the policy effectiveness and compliance, which also includes not just a look back at that individual policy development process, but also a process by which we could look at overall PDP process. One interesting thing I'll note here is that when people in the GNSO community use the term PDP, and when it's used in the bylaws currently, it's very confusing. It's actually used to refer to two different elements. It's used to refer to the council requesting an issues report. In the bylaws, it says to initiate a PDP, this is what you need to do. But it was also used in connection with the third stage, as up here, which is the initiation of the formal process of the policy development process by giving it to, in the old bylaws, the task forces under the new regime, more of a working group. So we're, and although we slip up from time to time, the goal is that when we use the term PDP, it's really for the initiation of a working group, sending the work to a working group, and which is separate from the planning and request for an issues report. So one other item I'll note here before you see this very daunting slide up there. What we did is we looked at not only what should go into a new bylaws. Right now, the PDP process, the entire process, is defined in the bylaws as an appendix or an annex to the bylaws. I believe it's Annex A. What we did, though, is realize that there are a number of elements of the policy process that should stay in the bylaws, but a number of elements that should really be moved to the rules of operation for the GNSO Council, and even more elements that should be more of a guideline, not a mandatory approach, but a guideline as to different things a working group could do or different things that could be done to initiate the process. What you have up here is a PowerPoint slide that shows you the different stages as we've defined them and different elements of each stage that we talked about. Everything from, and I'm not, I understand that you, most of you probably can't read that, but it should be in the handout. I'm hoping I'm not talking out of turn. Yes, it's in the handout towards the back. If you want to look to keep looking at that as we go through the stages. But it deals, again, with everything from the initiation of the policy process to ultimately, with certain types of policies, a board vote and implementation. So we'll just jump to the next slide, but keep going to the back of the executive summary and looking at that if you ever get confused as to where we are. So overall, there are 45 recommendations included in the report that link to different stages. Some recommendations actually affect multiple stages, and you'll see them twice. Some of the recommendations codify what's been going on the last several years in the policy process. Some recommend a completely new approach, and some, as we talked about, recommend the least flexible options, which are those things that go into the bylaws, and then some which are recommended to go into the rules of operation, which are more flexible, where unlike the bylaws, which have to be approved, go through a very formal process, have to be approved by the board of the ICANN Board of Directors, changes to the rules of operation for the council are voted on by the council, and the board does retain the right to review that, but there's no formal approval that is required by the board. All of these different elements, all these different recommendations are going to require your input as well. So with stage one, some of the key recommendations that came out of it, some of them are not you know, so novel, but certainly things that need to be codified, is a modification of the time frame for the creation of an issues report. In the current bylaws, the recommendation right now is that the bylaws require that an issues report be delivered to the council within 15 days of the initiation of the process. So with some of these issues, if they're narrow enough, that may not have been such a big issue for the community and, well, for ICANN staff that's responsible for putting together the issues report. But for a number of the issues that we've dealt with recently, whether it's vertical integration, whether it's the what's known as PEDNR, which post-expiration deletes, which Alan, who's up here, is the chair of that group, or many other issues that are just really complex, and to deliver a complete issues report takes a lot longer than could take a lot longer than 15 days. So our recommendation on that was to set the maximum time frame. The two options, the couple options we've put forward is: should we set a maximum time frame, because you don't want the initiation phase to take or the issues report to take such a long time period that the process keeps dragging on and on and on. So one option is to set a longer time frame than what's in the bylaws to something like 30 or 45 days. Or the other option is to, when the GNSO Council wants to initiate the process and get an issues report, is to ask ICANN staff directly, look, here's the issue we're thinking of exploring. Here's some of the things that we've noticed will already be issues that need to be reflected in that report. You come back in a couple days, come back to the GNSO Council mailing list, let us know how long you think it'll take, and then the council could then make a judgment. And by the way, this is open for comment. The people up here are members of the work team, as there are some members out there. I have James Bledel and Alan Greenberg, and of course I have Marika, who's the ICANN staff policy person. So yes, Alan.
This is one of my standard refrains, so you're now hearing part of our teleconferences. What Jeff just said is correct, or should be correct, if the GNSO is requesting the issues report. If the issues report is requested by an advisory committee, presumably staff will get back to the advisory committee.
So yeah, I'm glad you made that point. There are actually, and the report goes into that, there's three ways there's three different bodies that could, I should say there's more than three. There's three different ways that an issues report can be requested. It can be requested as what we see most often, I would say it's most often, is through the GNSO Council itself requesting the issues report. Alan, who's a member of the ALAC, the second approach is for an advisory committee, whether it's the ALAC, the ESAC, or the GAC, the Government Advisory Committee, can also request an issues report, for which there's different procedures that go around. So Alan's correct, where if an advisory committee asks for an issues report, then the second option that I read, which is asking ICANN staff how long it would take, would not go to the GNSO Council, but would go to the referral body. In that case, it would be the ALAC, or the ESAC, or the GAC. And, of course, if the board recommends an issues report, then, that'll be discussed between ICANN staff and the board. Another recommendation we had out of that report is for a public comment period after the publication of the issues report, before the GNSO Council actually votes on whether to initiate the formal PDP and set up a working group. This is not, at this time, this is not required in the bylaws. But with a number of the issues reports that have come out, with the complexity of the issues, the work team discussed this at length and thought that a comment period after the issues report would be something that could be a really good idea. Even if it takes a little bit longer to get to the council, it really could get those opinions other than ICANN staff, who's tasked with writing the issues report. Marika.
Just to add something to that, I think part of the thinking from a staff perspective on this would be, as there's normally a limited amount of time in which an issues report can be drafted, and staff only has so many resources at its disposal, that public comment period would also be attended to correct any data that's incorrect, or add any information that staff wasn't able to find or obtain, or alternative as well, because as the issues report normally provides a recommendation to the GNSO Council on whether or not to initiate a PDP as a specific element as well, to provide advice on that. I think, and it's linked to a recommendation that will come up, I think, in the second round, where there's also a public comment period currently after the initiation where information can be gathered, that if those two would be mandatory, it might make sense to focus this one actually on the issues report and not so much on debating the questions, but actually providing input on the actual issues report. Is there any factual inconsistencies, any information missing, and a specific question on initiation or not?
So if anyone, I just want to remind, if anyone has questions, or we're speaking too fast in foreign terms here, because this is very dense, please come on up to the mic, ask your question. Certainly want to get your feedback. The last issue, which actually is pretty controversial, at least was a topic we talked about at great length. Right now, under the bylaws, there's only one PDP process that has these long time frames associated with them. And there's really no mechanism in the bylaws to deal with something that is what some may call an emergency, or something that needs to be decided on a much faster track. And what's really interesting is when we started talking about this in the work team last year, there hadn't been many, or if any, issues that kind of fell into this category. Well, at the beginning of this year, we did have an issue that's come up, which is the issue on vertical integration, and became an issue that people wanted to address on a faster track because of the fact that the draft applicant guidebook was being developed, and we did not want to slow. In fact, it was a requirement of the GNSO Council resolution that the PDP not slow down the new TLD process. And we realized that there really is no process in the bylaws or in the rules of operation to have a faster track PDP. And I will tell you that this generated a lot of discussion in the work team, because we couldn't think of on our own necessarily certain criteria that would justify the certain objective criteria that could be applied that would justify a fast track. It became a lot easier once the vertical integration PDP came, But so we're looking for input from you all. We all know that there are issues may or situations may arise in which a fast track is necessary, and we're looking for your feedback on that. And Alan, you want to address that? And then James.
Yeah, I think that this discussion shows some of the fun in this group. The term fast track is used in a number of different ways. Jeff has given one of them. I tend to use it in something exactly the opposite end. That is, something which we know we need consensus policy to fix, but it's not particularly controversial. The answer is clear. There is currently no rules right now. For instance, in the domain tasting policy, we said we will have some reports and we may revisit it. But there is no process to revisit and make a minor tweak or change, even if everyone agrees to it, other than starting off with an issues report and going through the whole process. So there are certain things where it's easy to get consensus. We know what the answer is, but there is no process to do it without spending a year and a half and an awful lot of people resources. And from my point of view, that's one of the real needs of a fast track. I worry a little bit about vertical integration being considered fast track because it's a real critical issue, and I'm not sure we want to skip steps. So
Maybe we can go to the mic first, and then I'll chime in if you don't cover it there. So
sure.
And Bill, if you could state your name and...
Bill Smith with PayPal, and at the risk of beating a dead horse, could someone walk me through what happened this morning in the GNSO Council in establishing the drafting team for the DNS cert and how that applies or what path through this was taken?
And actually, we're just about to get to the... When we talk about the next slide, we're going to talk about drafting a charter, and I'll go through what I observed happening, and others may weigh in, but it brings us actually to the next recommendation. Let me get James's comment on the fast track, and then I'll go right to that.
Yeah, and just briefly, there was a lot of discussion, as Jeff mentioned, regarding fast track, and this is now day four of this marathon series of meetings. And one of the subjects that keeps coming up in just about every session involving the GNSO is the concept of how it manages its workload. And I think if we recognize that the GNSO has limited resources in terms of how many PDPs it can focus on in a quality manner at any given time, then the fast track, which we all agreed needed to exist, implies that some other work must have to suspend to make way for an expedited fast-track PDP or an urgent PDP. And I don't think that we've really identified that there's a mechanism to do that either. So I think that's just some of the complexities that we've had to explore while we were discussing this topic.
Thanks, James. And actually, what I want to do to answer the question that Bill had, and I didn't really do a great job of explaining this at all, but if you go back to the chart, there are a number of different actions that the GNSO Council can take. One of them is this formal policy development process, which is really a very formal process which could result in a consensus policy, meaning a change to the contracted parties' agreement, or the development of best practices. But it's really something that when the council initiates that process and it goes through the policy process, it's meant for the board, and the board has to do certain things, which we'll talk about a little bit later, with a formal PDP. But the GNSO council can also initiate other types of policy processes that are not the formal policy development process, which is what happened this morning. Was the concept of setting up an informal working group to work with the CCNSO on DNS cert. That was the proposal. It wasn't something that would result in this formal policy development process or necessarily a recommendation to the board or binding policy. So I'll let Marika also touch on that.
If we can just add something there, because what Jeff says is absolutely correct, because what you currently see in the bylaws, there's only a provision provided for what should happen in a policy development process. There's no other information, other kinds of processes that do happen in practice. I mean, there are joint working groups, ad hoc drafting teams that meet, but they don't have a formal prescribed process in the bylaws. And I think part of what we're trying to do here in this chart by making that distinguishing there, that first step on, like, are we looking at a policy issue? Do we think that, you know, consensus policies might be a potential outcome? Yes, if so, then we move into the policy development process. But if not, there you have the drop-down button that says then other policy other GNSO processes, and you'll find on, I can just find out which page, on page 20 of the outline, you find a little drop-down menu where we've highlighted some of those other GNSO processes that are currently being used. And I think the idea would be that, I don't think it's for this work team to probably, you know, prescribe what these groups can do and how they should work, but maybe in the future that some guidance might be provided on those kind of groups in the rules of procedure to provide some indication of what kind of different processes the GNSO can use to pursue some of its activities that are not the strict policy development processes.
Right, and to add to that, there are things that could be done in the informal process by the GNSO that at some point they realize, oh, wait a minute, we think this may result in a, or we may want it to result in a consensus policy. And at that point in time, they would have to leave the informal process and try to find an input or a way into the formal process so that it can result in that. It doesn't. So I understand this is actually a subject that, you know, for the first getting into this whole ICANN world or the GNSO world, it's kind of a very complex, and it takes a little while to get used to. But essentially, the what Mariko was talking about, just to try to reword if it helps, and then I'll move on if it doesn't, is a consensus policy that registries and registrars right now are bound by their agreements. The principal way to amend those agreements are through the development of a consensus policy. And if there is a development of a consensus policy, that will act as an amendment to the registry and registrar agreements. But not everything that the GNSO Council does is meant to amend the contracted party agreements. So, for example, when you enter a policy process like for DNS cert, they're entering into that, if it's not through the formal process, a number of them are entering into it to explore the issues that are involved. I'll give you another example that's going on right now, which the final report was released for the RAP, the Registration Abuse Policy Task Force, which was to recommend future PDPs, right? Their role was initiated by the GNSO to explore the issues that are out there, to do some research, to do some fact-finding, to figure out and possibly recommend to the GNSO Council whether PDPs, formal PDPs, should be conducted. And one of the recommendations of that group was to establish a PDP on a review of the UDRP. Now, it's up to the Council at this point as to decide whether or not they're going to initiate the formal PDP process, but that was not one of the outcomes of what the RAP group was set out to do. And Philip, you have a comment you want to add? Or
I mean, I can give a less politically correct interpretation of what happened earlier, if you like. The question was about the DNS cert drafting team being set up.
Right, right.
I mean, the first observation, I think, is that it was under the old rules and not the new rules that you're currently drafting. Second, I think my take on it was the council did not want to have the discussion about the merits or otherwise of the issue at council and deferred it to a drafting group to at least shape any subsequent argument. And the third observation is that the history of cooperation between the CCSO and the GNSO has been a rocky one. And I think if the GNSO chucked out of hand a hand being stretched from the CCs on an issue, I think that would have been politically naive, and I think that was probably a third element of what happened this morning.
Thank you, Phil.
Two quick comments. In terms of DNS cert, the comment was made that there was a comment period and the comments were uniformly negative, so why are we still talking about it? And part of the answer is because ICANN itself is still talking about it, and there are potential budget items regarding it, so we feel we cannot drop it at this point. In terms of the more general discussion we were having, ICANN really likes to use any given term in at least four different ways. And, you know, so we'll find the term consensus used multiple ways, stakeholder group, working group, and by definition it's confusing.
Okay, thanks, Alan. I want to jump on back to the policy process for a second because I don't want to rehash that debate. Certainly an interesting debate and certainly one that will keep going on for months to come, I'm sure. In stage two of the policy development process, once the council has voted to initiate the process and then has voted to the issues report is out, all the facts are before in the issues report, and that has been put out for public comment. Now the GNSO Council has decided, okay, we are going to create a working group. We're going to initiate the formal policy development process. In the bylaws right now, although we've been doing this for the last many years, we've been developing charters to govern the work, if you will, of the working group. It's actually not a requirement in the bylaws that a charter be developed. There is no requirement at all. I think with the way we've been operating, and if you've read the any of the recommendations from the Operational Steering Committee, and you've also read the working group work team, I think right now most people agree that a charter is an essential element of a working group, so it could keep the working group focused. A charter could be developed in a number of different ways, and the council has done this in several ways. A charter could always be proposed by the entity or the party that, or parties that want a policy process underway, or as the GNSO Council has done, once it decides to initiate the formal process, it could then issue an immediate call for a drafting team to develop this charter. Again, this is not a requirement currently in the bylaws, and so we all believe that this is a good development and should be something that is recommended from our policy development process work team to have that charter. Marilyn, do you have a comment?
My name is Marilyn Cade. I suffer from having been a former counselor. And in the days when I actually, and I enjoyed it greatly and feel that it was a fantastic experience, along with Philip Shepherd, who spoke earlier. I think that one of the interesting things that I have observed in being a part of this working group is that we seem to have lost our racial memory, and I don't mean the working group, but those of us who participate have lost the racial memory. We were having to, because we started at a flat start, we had to invent processes that made sense. And one of the things we came to realize is we had to have a charter because we had to establish parameters for what we were going to focus on. So the interesting thing to me is in the pre more mature stage of ICANN, we actually understood we had to have a charter. So I was actually quite surprised when we reached this point where we were trying to say, do we need to mandate a charter or not? And I'll just say my personal view is that scoping exercise is very important. And my personal view, both within the working group and external to it, is it's got to come as early as possible, including understanding what the group will do and what it won't do.
And actually, I'm going to jump to the fourth bullet here because you brought up the question of in scope. And that's an important question and one we actually had to talk about considerably in the work team. We found that in talking to members of the GNSO community, I think there was several different understandings of what the words in scope mean. So in the bylaws right now, to go back a step, it basically asks in an issues report, it asks the General Counsel's Office of ICANN and staff to produce a report and make a recommendation as to whether that particular issue is, quote, in scope or not. And there was really no guidance given to what in scope meant. Several years back, I can recall that contracted parties had one view of what in scope meant, and non-contracted parties had another view of what in scope meant. And there was really no guidance in the bylaws to say which one of those is the correct interpretation. So the work team got together and we discussed and it went back and forth. And I think the work team realized that really when you're talking at this stage of whether something is in scope, because the policy development process is not only about developing consensus policies, in other words, it's not only about amending the contracted party's contract, but also about a plethora of other things, that in scope in for this for the PDP process really means, is it in scope for the GNSO and ICANN? And I think that's a little bit of what the debate you heard this morning, if you were at the GNSO Council, there was a debate as to whether the particular issue you're talking about is in scope of the GNSO or not. No resolution on that. But I think when they were talking about in scope in that session that was going back and forth, they weren't talking about whether it was in scope of the contracted parties. They were talking about, is it in scope of the GNSO? Is that something that, is that policy? Is that something the GNSO should be addressing? So the work team pretty, I would say, a consensus of the work team agreed that for the PDP process at this stage, when you ask, when the general counsel provides advice as to whether a particular issue is in scope, it is actually or should be providing advice on whether it's in scope with the GNSO as opposed to whether it's in the scope of what could be amended in a registry or registrar contract. Philip?
Thanks. I think it's a good clarification that you're trying to make. And I think you're probably right. I think when we first had drafted that, I think there was a thought that it was probably to do with consensus policies and amending contracts, because that's actually far more fun, of course, than just tossing it off somewhere else. My serious question is, your current phrasing is within the scope of ICANN's mission and more specifically the role of the GNSO. Have you tested that out with the with ICANN Council yet, and are they happy with that?
We haven't at this stage.
Okay. I mean, I think I'd advise perhaps doing that as a next stage, only because it strikes me as slightly woolly in terms of the role of the GNSO. I mean, that's going to be the critical bit. And I think it actually echoes back to this question we just had about DNS cert. So I think you're on exactly the right track. It's just a question of choosing the words that legal counsel is going to be happy in terms of how they interpret.
Thank you, Phil. Marika?
I think the intention behind it was that, you know, scope of GNSO policymaking is right into GTLDs instead of, you know, CCTLDs or anything else. So, but absolutely agree that should be verified. And I think that's the idea as well, of course, going forward, once we have a better idea of the different elements that go into the Annex A or the new Annex A, that, of course, we'll work closely together with legal counsel to make sure that, you know, we get the language right and that it fits well. But thanks.
I'm going to go to Liz and then to Bill. Or was Bill first?
I was just going to offer that the clarification for scope is, in my opinion, it should be as defined in the bylaws.
I apologize.
Clarification for scope,
yes,
is quite simple. It should be as is defined in the bylaws. The bylaws have a statement about what the GNSO is supposed to do. And so for me, I'm a relative newcomer, but I come in, I read documents, and I see what's in scope, what I am attempting to say, this should be in scope, that shouldn't be in scope. And that's what I'm hearing here is, yes, we should have charters. I think the GNSO has a charter. It should be obvious what is in scope and what is not in scope. And I think in this case, the scope does refer to the bylaws that are the thing that actually empowers the GNSO to do anything.
Yeah, I think the classic example of where this came up was in February 2006 when there was a policy development process that was initiated on amending the contractual amendment or contractual conditions, I think it was called, and it was the GNSO was looking into certain provisions in the registry agreements and whether to modify them. And I don't know if I just took your comment, Liz, but... Okay, so I'll go through this one, then you can bring up the other example. And in fact, I was on the other side arguing that the GNSO shouldn't look into this because it was out of scope. Why did I say it was out of scope? Because it was out of scope of the contracts themselves didn't allow the GNSO, this is my view at the time, that didn't allow the GNSO to look at these issues because it couldn't have been implemented even if they wanted to. In other words, even if the GNSO Council came out with a recommendation, or GNSO community came out with a recommendation that says that this clause in this contract should be changed to this wording, my view was that that could never be enforced because the contracts wouldn't allow them to be. And I think the General Counsel at the time had clarified, look, it's in scope within the, it may be within the scope of the GNSO, but the outcome that the that some people had wanted may have been out of scope of the particular contract. And I think the debate kept getting confused, including on my part. I mean, I'm willing to admit I was a little wrong on some of it, although right on the outcome. But I was definitely one that was arguing that it was out of scope for the PDP, and that's where it really got clarified, kind of like exactly what you said, right? It should seem obvious, but at the time it wasn't. So, Liz, another example? Or?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Jeff. My name's Liz Williams. I was the policy development person who was responsible for the PDP February 06, which Jeff is referring to, and I have to tell you that the biggest waste of energy was an argument about scope. So I would urge you not to take on any project that is outside the scope of the bylaws. It is a rabbit hole that you do not want to go down, and it's a hang of a bunch of trouble. The issue is that even if it's in scope within what you roughly think the GNSO is capable of doing, you're precisely right, and I'm sorry I don't know your name. Bill, thank you, Bill. Thank you, Marilyn, I mean. The issue is that if you're going to spend a lot of resources with very busy people in a very crowded calendar, you must only focus on things that are within the picket fence scope of the capacity of anything to be amending a contracted party's contract. Now, you and I, Jeff, had a very, very long set of conversations for about 18 months on the February 06 PDP, and I was in the middle of the analysis going back to the General Counsel. I was in the middle of parties that disagreed with you, and it makes life extremely difficult for now people like Marika and others to be involved in PDPs that there is doubt about the scope. So I urge you only to focus on things that are constrained by the bylaws and be very, very clear that when you're writing the charter for an establishment of a PDP, that everyone knows, and most of us in this room and anyone who comes into it, can pretty much guess where it's going to end up, and then you have to deal with weighted voting. Then you have to deal with the contracted parties and the implications of the contracted parties, non-contracted parties. So, you know, bottom line is be really, really precise. And I agreed with the comments this morning that, you know, the GNSO might be interested in doing this, but it is not within its remit. And the counterbalance to that is a constant complaint about we have too much work to do and we have not enough resources. And one way of constraining that is being very, very precise about what you can work on. Now, it's not all sexy and gorgeous, but you have to focus.
I agree with those comments, and I think that focusing on the scope at the beginning is helpful in the sense that if, you know, it comes up all the time. I mean, even now there's arguments or debate in the registrar accreditation agreements, as to... You know, it certainly may well be within scope to discuss the issues in the agreement, but the amendment itself may or may not be out of scope. So it's possible. Again, I'm not offering an opinion as to whether it is or isn't. But the point is that it's possible that a topic could certainly be within the scope, but the implementation or certain forms of implementation may not be in scope for a particular contract. Let's say. And I think that's, as Liz was saying, it's important if we could, when you start the policy process, if you could know that up front and not waste a lot of energy on arguing whether something's in or out of scope and then, you know, really focus on what the possible outcomes are. I think that's very, very helpful. I know that that James and Alan have to go to another meeting at this point, so it'll just be the two of us up here. Oh, you want to?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that this has been a very, very long process, and I just wanted to offer my compliments to Jeff and to Marika for keeping us on track for the last year. This is, as we mentioned, this stuff is a really good lullaby if you're not right, you know, over caffeinated properly to deal with it on 8 o'clock on a Thursday morning. And so I appreciate both of your efforts, and sorry that we have a conflict.
Thanks, Bill. You want
to? Sure, Bill Smith, PayPal. And while I haven't been a party to these discussions, I also know how hard it is to do these things. So. All right. I want to let you be sure you know that I understand that. I guess I would offer for recommendation 24 that we consider, all right, for clarifying scope, that the definition just simply be that the scope shall be as defined in Article 10, Section 1 of the bylaws, which is the generic name supporting organization description. There shall be a policy development body known as the generic name supporting organization, GNSO, which shall be responsible for developing and recommending to the ICANN board substantive policies relating to generic top-level domains. It's very clear.
Well, it's kind of circular in that clear way. Yeah. But I think you're right, and the wording in the bylaws may say that, but we may put in the rules of operation some guidelines on how to interpret that. So, again, those are guidelines for the definition you read is a little bit circular, right?
That's fine, but the bylaws speak very loudly. Okay, if not, then this organization is being run in a very ad hoc manner. That's my suggestion. Okay, so as a relative newcomer, somewhat an outsider, what I'm seeing is some scope creep, and it's concerning. So I'm suggesting in this recommendation that this group should consider saying the scope is as defined in the bylaws, because that's where its scope is defined.
Okay. Marilyn, you have a comment on that?
My name is Marilyn Cade, and I was heavily involved in the PDP-06 as the catalyst to challenge an interpretation by staff, and that went to an interpretation by the General Counsel. But I'd like to support what Bill just said, because I think the way that Bill proposed it does leave, you know, scope has to be defined by the bylaws. That may mean it still gets interpreted, and that interpretation would take place if challenged, I think. Right, Bill? That would be that, you know, for those of us who've worked in big corporations, and many of you have, and in multilateral organizations, the fewer words you use, the better off you are. And I was just thinking, in response to your comment, that actually it should say the scope is as defined by bylaws, by the bylaws. If the bylaws change, then that would change the scope.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That probably, I hadn't thought about it before, but I think Bill's suggestion might actually be very helpful to us.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I just want to just make a distinction here as to, you know, one thing we're trying to do is to revise the process and reflect that in the bylaws where appropriate, and in this case, obviously, it would be appropriate. But I think another thing we're trying to do is, one of the missions of the group is to really create some sort of, I'll call it a handbook for a lack of a better term, because just to guide counselors when they get on the council, just to help them understand what it means. It's not legally binding. It wouldn't be intended to be the legal definition. You know, it would have the caveat or the disclaimer at the end that says, you know, these are just interpretations or a handbook, but for the official language, look back to the bylaws, right? So what we're saying is in the Annex A, it could say the mission is as defined, or the in scope is as defined in Article 10, Section 1. But when you come onto the council and you're a new member, you really want to understand or want some handbook that tells you or tries to provide you some guidance on what that means. You know, most of the people on the council are not lawyers. Most of the people on council have other types of jobs, and you know, a handbook in helping them deal with council issues or deal with if a question of in scope comes up, to help them understand, like a kind of like an FAQ, if you will, as to what that means. Not legally binding, wouldn't set the legal precedent, but something that helps them.
Sorry, I'm just going to do a response here. So I think you're explaining what might go into the narrative that says, for example...
Well, bylaws don't have narrative, so there's a difference.
I
so if you mean in the report, yes, or in a handbook, yes. Yes,
okay.
It would be kind of so I wouldn't even put it as a rules of procedure, right? We were talking about basically three different outputs.
Right.
You have changes to the bylaws, you have a rules of procedure,
right?
And then you would have more of a handbook, guidebook, something to help like a counselor 101.
So Jeff, I think it'd be possible in the handbook to say, for example, there have been times when a counselor or the council has asked for clarification of this. In that instance, this is what you would do.
Right.
But I think that's different than having very clear language that says in scope is defined by the bylaws. So
correct.
I'm not disagreeing with either one of those things.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, let me yes, Ray, please.
Yeah, just a real quick question, and Ray Fassett, by the way. Just a real quick question on this issue of scope kind of dovetails into the idea where the rubber really hits the road. Is it a consensus policy, capital CP, or is it not a consensus policy? Does it fit within the scope that way? Because so maybe to Bill's point, you have the bylaws that says this, and then it branches off from there into one of these other two buckets. How are you looking to educate the council members on this point? Because I think this was one of the positives that came out of February 06 PDP was a more educational process that there is a difference between what is absolutely beneficial, which could be a best of practice recommendation,
mm-hmm.
versus this is a capital C, capital P consensus policy that has potentially ramifications upon contracted parties, and that I think that came out. That was one of the benefits that came out of it was his education process. But so in that spirit, have you considered how for council members as they come in and turn over, how they will understand as it relates to scope, the idea of consensus policies versus best of practices? Because and then I'll just finish with one thought, because then we ran into the problem because when we went to in that February 06 process, we went to ICANN staff, particularly council, looking to get some guidance up front before a lot of work was starting, only to find where they really couldn't give an opinion until there was output to be able to make a decision on, which made a real chicken and egg thing and a lot of work for everybody and a lot of effort. So that's my question, is how you're looking to address that part.
You want to?
Yeah, Susan Ricker, so that's indeed a very valid point you made, and I think something we encountered as well in some of the recent issues report, where indeed we need to look at scope, and where you look at very broad issues, it's like, well, it's impossible, like, if you define scope as the narrow, like, could it be a consensus policy outcome or not, which is basically impossible, and often something that becomes clear at the end of a policy development process. But in response to your question, like how can you educate councillors, inform them on that? We have actually, and Margie Milam, she actually just left, has a presentation on that we've been given on various intervals now, and I think definitely a link on that would be included in any kind of manual or guidebook that we would develop on that discussion on, what is the difference between, the consensus policy and other discussions, and which topics or which elements are part of, the picket fence and could have as a potential outcome, binding obligations on contracted parties. Because we've encountered that indeed on various occasions where people weren't aware. And then, even from a staff perspective, before I understood the difference and how that worked, it's a very complicated process. So I think further guidance is definitely helpful.
Yeah. So to follow up, it appears your working group has spent some time, quite a bit of time on this particular issue. That was really my question. Thank you very much.
Yes, thanks, Ray. Yeah, we have, and it was definitely debated back and forth as to, just like you said, there was a lot of frustration in that because some people in the February 06 really had a feeling that, but we know if this is the output that's produced, that's not within the, quote, what they call the picket fence or within the definition of consensus policies within the contracts. And so a number of people said, well, why would we go through this entire process if we know that the output that certain people want is not going to be in scope of the contracts? And it's definitely a tension as Ray was saying, because the general counsel's view, which is correct, is how can we make a determination if we don't even know definitively what the output's going to be? So it was, we certainly spent a lot of time and several calls discussing that one in particular. The other issue that came up with the work team before we jumped to stage two that I want to point out is priorities of PDPs. So right now, in the policy development process, there are very strict timelines that have to be followed regardless of what else is going on in the council or in the GNSO community at the time. And that's not just PDPs, other PDPs that may be going on, but other items, whether it's other working groups or just other larger issues like internet governance or whatever else is going on in the community that people have to devote resources to. In the bylaws right now, they're very hard timelines. You start a PDP, within 20 days you get certain kind of input. Within 35 days you have to get constituency statements. Within 15 days after that, or whatever it is, you have to have an initial report. Within 30 days after that, you have to have comments submitted. After that, you have to have a final report. And it's all within, I would say, a 90 to 120 day period. It doesn't consider at all anything that's going on in the council or in the community. And that's a problem. It's a problem because while the GNSO community may want a policy development process on a particular topic, you know, you're faced with the decision. If I initiate the PDP now, it has to be done in 120 days or 90 days, but I know that's not possible. So do I just delay the vote on initiating the PDP, or is there some other process where the GNSO Council can prioritize which PDPs are going on, initiate a PDP, but have it put back in terms of priority if it's not number one, or alternatively, if there are PDPs already underway, how to move that PDP up or down in priority. And we were kind of relying on the GNSO Council's priority process that's going on. It's taking a little bit longer. So in our report, when you read it, it's really just kind of punting the issue or deferring to what the council comes up with. And I think this one, we're hoping the council comes up with something in the next couple months that we can just incorporate into our report. So we want to jump on to the next slide. So stage three is the stage that deals with the actual work that's being done with the working group. And the mandate of our team was not to recreate all of the work that was done by the working group work team, which is to talk about how, you know, what goes into a charter, statements of interest, how members of working groups elect a chair, a vice chair, how they interrelate with each other. That was not our role was to do basically everything kind of around that issue. So if you look at, for example, recommendation 28, which is the duration of a public comment period on an initial report. In that recommendation, or in the bylaws today, it's basically a fixed timeline. You release the initial report. It's 20 days to respond, and really doesn't say any, doesn't leave any room for flexibility. And so we obviously made a recommendation in our report to give a little bit more flexibility or a little bit more time to respond to a initial report. One thing I'll jump in here, which is actually an overarching issue, is the whole issue of translation. And where it plays here in what I was just talking about is, okay, let's say you have a 30-day period. Well, that's great if the report comes out in English and you're an English native speaker and you're able to reply in English. You know, 30 days may certainly be enough time, but what if you're not? And, you know, what if it takes time to get a report or parts of a report translated and to have the capability of receiving comments in those other languages, you know, really is 30 days enough? And so all of these issues, again, that's an overarching issue that with translation that fits in many different stages, or in all of the stages, I should say, and it's something that needs to be kept in mind when we do create timelines. And you know, the more strict we are, the harder it is to get those translations and get comments in other languages. One other one I want to highlight here. Oh, sorry, go on.
Yep. So, and I've worked in other fora that allow work groups basically to form where the language of the work group is stated at its initiation, the language that things will be conducted in, and translations are done after the fact. They're not requiring simultaneous translation, basically, of documents as you go along, but the work goes on in the native language for the group.
And I think
Something like that, I think, could be used here.
And actually, that is an I believe, Marika, correct me if I'm wrong, in the working group work team report, the final report, they did recommend that, just like ICANN states that the language that things will be done in is English, the working group work team in their final report made the same recommendation. However, even if the work of the working group is done in English, you're right. After the fact, you do need to consider translating that and providing ample opportunity for people that speak languages other than English to provide feedback. So even if the work in the working group is done in one language, you know, it's not necessarily saying that you shouldn't, as you said, translate something after the fact to get as broad of to get as broad feedback as you can. One of the other recommendations is, at this point, the bylaws state that the only deliverables of a working group are an initial report and a final report. Doesn't address things like surveys. Doesn't address other reports that may not be initial or final. And I know you kind of think, well, what could that be? And I'll use the vertical integration working group as an example. In that working group, we were all working as best we could to come out with officially what is an initial report. But we realized as Brussels, as this meeting got closer, that what we were able to produce wasn't really an initial report. It didn't have recommendations. It had discussions of what the issues are. And I don't even think these documents made it. But at the time that the working group was discussing it, there was, you know, a matrix of different options there, but there were no real recommendations. And so that's not an initial report, certainly not a final report. What is it? And so the work team discussed this, and just basically the recommendation is to leave it very flexible. You can have as many different types of outputs as you want, so long as the bare minimum is an initial report and a final report. But anything else the work team or the working group wants as deliverables, they're free to release that, to distribute that, to get feedback on as they see fit.
Because one of the open questions there is still, if you look at the bylaws, you know, describes, and the same for the issues report, it describes some elements that an initial report should have, and the question will be, should that information be in the bylaws, or should it be something in the rules of procedure, and there should be more flexibility around what a working group puts in there, or are there certain elements that should be required? For example, as Jeff said, for example, should an initial report always have draft recommendations? Otherwise, it's not an initial report. And so those are the questions as well that the group is looking input on.
Marilyn?
Yeah, but question, I guess, from having been involved in so many of these before. And again, I'll go back to the idea that we debated the question of if we were leading a conclusion by putting draft recommendations in an issues report. The difference between having an issues report that scopes the issue and is more of a white paper about the issue, including background, how it's relevant to ICANN. I could use a few examples about, and how that particularly then, that issue is particularly relevant to the GNSO policy process. One thing I might just say, it would be helpful for all of us if we were distinct in the use of our phrases and understand that the GNSO is the GNSO supporting organization and the GNSO council is the council that, according to the bylaws, only focuses on policy management. And I say that because something could be of broad interest to the GNSO, but still doesn't belong in an issues report being developed by the policy council. And so that brings me to this. Sorry, now I have to leave the microphone and go look at this. Move to the other microphone so I can read. So I want to focus on recommendation 31, the working group input on issues related to implementation. We fought this battle pretty hard about, at some point we finished policy and we handed off to staff for implementation. And the idea that the working group might pre-identify issues related to implementation and might provide their insights, if they in fact are based on information and fact, about implementation, I think is something to think about. But I think, Jeff, we may need to really think about, you turn something over to the staff for implementation, it cannot be overseen by the policy council. So do we actually have a provision for when a sub-element is determined not to be final or not to be finished in terms of its policy implementations, and that sub-element needs to be returned to the policy for further work? And I don't think we addressed that.
Well, I think in a later recommendation, and I'm not sure it's one we highlighted in the slide presentation, but we definitely do have a it is in 40 recommendation 42. We do actually state that I'm just jumping ahead here, that we do recommend the creation of a working group implementation review team, which would be responsible for reviewing that type of implementation issues. Now, that review team can be the exact same as the working group initial team. You know, we kind of left it up to the council to decide whether those are the exact same teams or whether they create a new team comprised of the community, because some people may not have an interest in the initial working group in working on the implementation. I find that rare, but it could happen. So the short answer is yes, that we believe that there should be oversight by the GNSO community as opposed to the council, but whether that's the exact same work team or whether, like in the transfers, it was actually a different working group work team, although comprised of many of the same players, it was actually a different work team or working group.
Well, maybe I've had a rare insightful moment since this was being thought about, but I'm really thinking out loud about the issues of conflicts of interest, which the policy development process may provide safeguards, because the discussion is about policy development, and there are certain antitrust safe harbors that can be taken advantage of when you are talking only about policy. But things get very complicated, and I apologize. This has just occurred to me now. If competitors are moving into oversight of an implementation process which affects their business interest, and I might just say, Marika, I'm sorry I didn't think about this, but maybe you might take this up with the council and about this issue of if the working group is going to and somehow oversee implementation and be able to influence the implementation, well meaning though that may be, there may be something different than just declaring interest in the policy in the policy development process.
Yeah, I think we had quite extensive discussions in the work team on this issue as well, and with the question like, indeed, how can you avoid gaming of that kind of system where people suddenly go, maybe they didn't like the policy outcome that much, but when they see it in implementation or people have changed and they suddenly want to go back on the issues, how to avoid indeed that such kind of a process wouldn't be used as an option just to change the policy or indeed have influence over the implementation that doesn't really follow the policy recommendation. And I think one of the options that was discussed there that it actually should be the council, like maybe on the recommendation of such an implementation review team or of an issue that's brought by the community that actually is the decider of saying, well, we really see that this is a policy issue that is being addressed through implementation and it doesn't follow the actual recommendation, so that you do have a kind of system in place that is just not the working group saying, hey, we don't really like the implementation and we actually thought the policy wasn't that great to start with, so maybe we use this process as a backdoor to make some changes now. So the group has discussed it, and I think you find it, I don't think in this recommendation, but maybe in the notes a bit, what the thinking was and the kind of safeguards you need to build in such a process to make sure that you avoid that kind of gaming of the system as you described.
Yes, and I think I think that always that balance always needs to be struck, and I definitely think as ICANN matures as an organization, they should certainly be. There are plenty of other organizations where competitors come together, where they're given the we call it the sermon, the antitrust sermon, where there's someone that the organization retains to remind those participating about the rules and what would constitute those types of or would create some of those types of issues. So I want to get I understand what you're saying, and a balance definitely needs to be struck, because you can't on the one hand say those guys can't be part of the implementation because they're probably the only ones that can tell you how or in certain circumstances how it could be implemented. On the other hand, you're absolutely right that could present certain competition issues.
Let me just say for the record that this looks to me, and perhaps I just didn't catch it before, this looks to me like the volunteer stakeholder community is supervising the implementation. And that I think we would have to draw the line at, because the accountability for implementing policy is not in the hands of the stakeholders, it is in the hands of the staff. That's the clarification I'm just trying to strive for.
Right, and I think the terms we use are, an implementation review team, which would be responsible in dealing with, as opposed to what maybe it was a mistake that I said actually earlier on, where I said the word oversight. I shouldn't have used that term. What we say in the report is actually in dealing with, but certainly I think a clarification of what you're saying it should be addressed. Philip.
Thanks. I share Marilyn's concern about the differences there, in particular the antitrust implications. And I think also possibly, in fact, the wording in the executive summary is more accurate, maybe also than the narrative you just gave, Jeff, when you said maybe the same working group would transform into this implementation review team. I think actually there are very good reasons for that not being the case, and in fact you're actually advising against it being the case. One we discussed in terms of potential antitrust. And I think it would help at the time you got to implementation review anyway, that you had a new team and therefore a system where statements of interest and declaration of interest are remade. But also I think probably, just from a practical point of view, you probably want a smaller size team anyway in terms of the second one rather than the first, which might be much broader. So I think there's good reasons for keeping those two separate.
Yeah, and I think those are excellent points. And what we have in the report is really the flexibility of the council to determine the size, to take into consideration the size of the review team, we left it pretty flexible so that we weren't setting the rule as to this has to be the composition of the review team. You could also, in theory, set up a review team where you have some players that are participating in the sense of providing input or facts or descriptions of their systems or whatever it is, but may not be, I'll use the word, although we hate using it, voting. They may not be part of how you determine whether it's consensus, but you may be drawing on them for their expertise. And I know we're running short of time, so I do want to go to stage four. And an interesting thing that we pointed out, and this was kind of controversial, at least within the work team, and controversial issues are good because they're actually more fun to talk about. And so in the bylaws right now, it basically states that you need after the working group acts and they come up with recommendations and they send it up to the council and they follow all the right processes, at the end of it, the council does vote. And there are certain requirements of how the council votes in order to pass something to the board. And what the bylaws, and I'm paraphrasing, but essentially they state that if there's a supermajority and they pass that, the supermajority approval on the recommendations of the report, whatever it is they send up, at that point in time, if there's a supermajority, then the board they have certain responsibilities or they have certain limitations. So they have to approve it unless a certain percentage of the board disagrees, and if they do, then there's a process for them to follow. If there's not a supermajority within the council, all the bylaws state right now is that a majority is sufficient to act. It is sufficient for the board to act. What does that mean? And that's been interpreted differently by different players, especially if it relates to a consensus policy. The contracted parties have argued that okay, the board can get the recommendations. That's great. So they can, you know, you don't want to stop the GNSO Council from passing it to the board. And the board can possibly endorse those recommendations, but the contracted parties take the view that that can't be enforced against the contracted parties as a capital C, capital P consensus policy, that only if you have a supermajority can the board actually force that on the contracted parties because it fits within the definition of the C, the capital C consensus policies. The non-contracted parties argue that that isn't the case, that the bylaws, if that were the case, the bylaws would say that, and a majority sufficient to act. From some non-contracted parties within our work team have argued that too should be binding on the contracted parties because the board is acting. And so I think that's it's an open issue. It's one that fortunately we haven't had to address yet, but it's one that I could easily foresee us addressing at some point in the future. And, you know, I encourage everyone to think about it. It's certainly, you know, taking off my chair hat, it's certainly important as a contracted party myself, it's certainly important to have clarity on exactly what that means. I think that's actually important not just for me as a registry, it's important for everyone in the community. And so there are differing viewpoints out there, and I think that's something that people should comment on. And Bill, you have a comment.
Yeah, I appreciate you. Bill Smith, PayPal. Sorry. Just reading this section of the bylaws. And it's very, I find it very strange, basically, because what I believe what 13E and F combine to do is to say that if a policy recommendation comes through the council with a supermajority vote, the board then has to have a supermajority vote. This says to affirm, I believe.
No, it's actually the opposite.
It's not in the interest. Okay.
Yeah, the board has to approve unless a supermajority.
But if a supermajority can't be obtained below, then only a majority of the board can act. But it shouldn't even be passed to the board.
I think. In interpreting, I think what they, and this is again all interpretation, but I think what they were trying to do, and I was involved actually in that early on, what I think we were trying to say is that if it didn't have a supermajority but had a majority, it still felt that the board should get the report and see the recommendations. Take it out of the consensus policy process. Forget about amending contracts. Let's just talk about other types of policy development where it could be the development of best practices, for example, or it could be development of guidelines or a whole host of other things. We didn't want to say that that couldn't be forwarded to the board if you didn't have a supermajority, because it doesn't really make sense if all you're talking about are best practices. However, if you are talking about consensus policies, in other words, if there's a recommendation from the community and approved by the council by a majority, and all it says is we think these should be recommended best practices for registries, that they should be doing X, Y, and Z. We didn't think at the time that that should prevent that from going to the board simply because it didn't get a supermajority. However, if the report said we believe that the contract should be amended and that registries must do these practices, at that point in time, the contracted parties say, yeah, you could forward that to the board. And maybe the board can convert that to best practices or can say, that sounds like, you know, thank you for the report. It sounds like that's a good idea. But the board couldn't empower the staff to put that into the registry agreements because it didn't reach the supermajority level. So that's, I mean, all of these things, whether my interpretation is right or others' interpretations is right, it's never been tested, but certainly we need comment on it to figure out which is the right way. Or which is our recommended way.
If I could.
Yes. Just, yeah.
In listening to what your description there, I would suggest that going back to scope again would help, right? Because what I'm hearing as somebody who's done a fair amount of process is you're trying to make a distinction between stuff that is, in my opinion, clearly within the scope of the GNSO, okay, capital C, right, policy, consensus policy.
Actually, so,
and then you were talking about guidelines and other things, and you wanted to treat those distinctly, yet the bylaws are only talking about one type of vote. So you have a problem from a process standpoint in that, I believe, the bylaws as I read them are talking about, you know, consensus policy, capital C, capital P. And what I'm hearing is the GNSO as an organization is also trying to figure out how we deal with all these things that aren't actually consensus policies, and what voting mechanisms do we use for those. And that's getting very confusing.
I agree with you. I think it is very confusing in the existing bylaws. And one of the outputs of this group is to make recommendations on changes to the bylaws so that we can try to clarify those items. I think over the years we've realized that there are other possible outcomes other than consensus policies. Other than capital C, consensus, capital P, policies that are defined in the agreements. And so what we're trying to do is to figure out how the GNSO, how this process can allow for those multiple types of outputs.
Right, and I'm just suggesting that you need to, and I heard it before, there needs to be a clear distinction. If you can do both, the distinction needs to occur early on, because that'll determine which path you take through whatever process you are using. But if you try and keep it together the way it is, at every stage you're going to have a fork in the road to worry about.
Yep.
And just to comment, I think in theory that would be the perfect approach, but often the problem is that, you know, it doesn't become clear until the end of the process, at the end of the PDP, what the actual recommendations are and whether these are indeed changes to contracts or not. And sometimes, you know, elements are linked, that you have best practices, but certain elements are actually going to be part of consensus policy. So,
let me go to.
And I'm happy to discuss, you know, further after the session.
Okay, let me go to Philip and then to Marilyn.
And before you leave, you know, just really like to strongly recommend you to submit some of those comments to the public comment forum, so
please,
that the whole work team can, you know, review those as well and then discuss them in further detail. And again, you know, if anyone wants to join the work team, still plenty of opportunity to provide input too. Thank you.
Come on in.
I mean, for me, the question we've just been discussing has a little bit of historical context, because previously the board got a recommendation from the then DNSO and could more or less do with it what it chose.
Yep.
And the intent of the last reform was to say that if the bottom-up process has worked satisfactorily and the community speaks with a sufficiently unified voice, and we define that by supermajority, mm-hmm. Then essentially the board is obliged to act upon those recommendations,
mm-hmm.
Which left open the question, well, what if it doesn't speak with such unified voice? And I think I agree with you, actually. That is an area that is still a little bit grayer than it should be. And I think, you know, again, one useful output is to say, let's have some clarity there.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I think that's how we got to where we are, as Byzantine as it sounds.
Yeah, I think that's actually real helpful, because I had forgotten some of those details, and so I do definitely appreciate that background.
And if I may just go, I also had a question about any discussion you might have had on recommendation 13, which is this concept of between the issues report and kicking off the PDP. It's on page 8. You had the idea of an impact analysis being requested, which could be an option for council to decide upon that. Now, that sounds like a potentially good idea. My only concern is, and did you have the discussion about the fun that could be had in terms of gaming that? And certainly we have experience in the past on council where essentially if you don't want the PDP to go ahead, you're looking for any possible obstruction mechanism. And to my mind, saying, hey, let's call for a study, to it, who is, is of course a great delaying tactic. So, you know, are you introducing a sensible, you know, point of analysis here, or are you introducing a possibility for delay? Will be my only open question there.
Yeah, I think that's I understand what you're saying, and I think we have to think about it in terms of preventing the gaming. However, it could also, I mean, the other side of the coin is an impact analysis, and not just on the contracted parties, but on, you know, we make it very clear, on the community needs to be done, just so you want to know going in if what you're recommending or what's a potential outcome is so costly or just way out there, you want to also be able to know that as well. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it has been used in the past. It's being used now as delay tactic, I think, by different members of the community, and people need to hopefully see through that from whoever does, from whoever's trying to game that. And I think you're right. If I could jump to stage five, and then we're almost done. We're almost out of time here. What's that? Oh, yeah. Well, this is more stage five. The importance of this is not at all in the bylaws at this point, and it's never really been done, which is to go back and review the individual PDP and then also on a more long-term basis to review the entire PDP process. Now, in some PDPs or in some of the reports that have been adopted, like domain tasting, there is actually a call in the report that says that this should be done. We thought that's a really good idea. That should probably be institutionalized, and you should have, or we're recommending that working groups consider whether there's an assessment or how the assessment is done. How do you measure the success of the individual policy development process or of the outcome of that? And so we think that it's been implemented in recent PDPs where they've suggested that, and we actually have seen, kind of interestingly enough, with domain tasting, the policy was so successful that people got tired of receiving the reports every 6 months. In other words, in that case, it called for every 6 months you need to issue a report on how the limitations that we set out for domain tasting have worked. Every 6 months the report's been delivered, and now the council's like, okay, enough already. We see that it's working. But it could have gone the other way, and so obviously these assessments are extremely important. If I could jump to the overall issues, these were the toughest ones for the work team to address, especially the well, we didn't even address the fifth one, which is, you know, once we do come up with this final new PDP process, how the heck do we transition to that? What do we do with all of the existing policy development processes that are underway or about to be underway? So we didn't really get our heads wrapped around that one because we thought, well, let's decide what the new process is, but we certainly want feedback if you have any thoughts on it. With the other, I would say the top three of those, really the, and I guess more important, the top two for now, is really timing. The issue of timing permeates throughout every process. How many days do you give to have this deliverable? How many days until the next deliverable? How many days for public comment? Constantly comes up. And we constantly hear the complaint now that everything's too short in the bylaws. It's too short for public comment period. It's too short for an issues report. So on the one hand, we certainly want to extend those timelines and provide flexibility. On the other hand, we don't want these policy processes to go on for years. What's the appropriate balance? How do we deal with those issues? And in certain sections of the report, you will see where we do recommend certain timelines, and we do recommend at the same time flexibility around those timelines for certain issues that come up. So we're looking for your help to make sure that we can have effective, efficient policy development processes that do not drag on forever, but that also allow enough flexibility to make sure you're getting the right input into the process and to make sure you get the best possible outcome. So with that said, you know, the documents, you know, the places we want to point you to are the initial report and draft recommendations, which are the sites up there right now. It's also on the main ICANN page, I believe, in the announcement section. You know, obviously there's a public forum, a comment forum that's underway tentatively to close on July 21st. I've already made it clear that I'd like that extended, and I don't think, because, interestingly enough, our process is not a PDP. In other words, the process to determine the new PDP is actually not a PDP itself. So we're not actually bound by any timelines. That said, we don't want it to drag on. So we are planning on increasing the timeline to get feedback. Very important to get all of the stakeholder groups, all the constituencies, all of the advisory committees to get reports back to us as soon as you can. It's really going to help our work and really help us answer these questions that we've kind of tossed around. And if you want to see a lot of the background, you have that interest and you want to hear some of the or see some of the transcripts, not transcripts, but hear some of the recordings of the past calls, you can go to the workspace that's set up at that address there. This slide presentation is going to be available on the ICANN site, is available on the ICANN site under this particular, if you go to schedule and you go to this particular work session, it'll be there. And really, I want to offer a lot of thanks, I think the next slide, to all of the people on the committee. There are a lot of us, and it's a lot of work, it's a lot of issues. And, you know, look, I'm up here as the chair, but really the work's being done by all of these people. And, you know, I'm just trying to kind of steer them along and make sure they're getting the work done. But these are the people that are doing the work. And so they're the people that really deserve a lot of the credit. And actually, I really want to thank Marika, because she's the one who helps compile all of the information and helps put it into the report. It is a 150-page report, which I understand is extremely long, but really the part that you were given when you came in, the 24 pages, that's the heart of the recommendations. And if you want to look into how we came to these recommendations and a little bit of insight with notes and background, you know, you could read the rest of the, you should read the rest of the report. So with that said, is there, you know, we've been taking questions throughout. Does anybody have any additional questions or comments? I'll let Marilyn maybe have the final word.
Maybe. When we, years ago, far away, in the earlier days of ICANN, the council did a self-review in which it determined that reforming the PDP was a number one priority. The council then began actually to call for that, and I am talking years ago, right? Then we had a review. We called for a review of an update of the PDP, et cetera, et cetera. I think the PDP really forms the heart, and I want to make a distinction, and I might ask Marika if we might think about how we capture this. GNSO is not the council, and the council is not the GNSO. The council is the body by which we manage the policy development process within the GNSO. And when people begin calling the council the GNSO, they do both a disservice. So I understand sometimes it's shorthand. We all do it in the community, but I'll make a pledge to have a pen made and handed out saying, remember, it's the council, not the GNSO. But I make that point to make this point. In order for the council to be effective at its job of managing policy, the PDP process and the working group processes have to be in place. Otherwise, the council is unable to move to its management role, which we may be seeing a lot of evidence of. So how soon could we get even a prototype PDP out there, do you think, Jeff? And if we were successful in recruiting Bill and three other people to be active members, would that help?
I think that's a very good question. You're putting me on the spot. You know, the comments should come in, and hopefully we'll have enough comments to answer a lot of the questions. The more people that participate in the calls and can help us do that, the quicker we'll go. I mean, it is our goal to have a final report and recommendations by, you know, certainly by the next meeting in Cartagena.
One caveat there maybe is that as this report just outlines the recommendations and not the actual new PDP yet, one question the work team probably would need to ask itself once it comes up with its almost final recommendations and proposed bylaw language, whether that should first be turned back again to the community before it actually hands in its final report to the PPSC. It's a consideration the group might want to make, or it might say, well, we hand in our draft final report to the PPSC and then leave it up to that committee to run another public comment period and take it from there. So that's a consideration a group might want to make, as you know, we don't provide, for example, draft bylaw language in this document yet.
Well, one of the things we've talked about quite a bit is not embedding detailed language into bylaws. That's generally a bad idea. Generally, high-level language saying there should be a policy development process established, blah, 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 then allows you to, you know, But the PDP would have to be in the procedures of the council, it seems to me. But let me ask a different question. So I would assume once the recommendations are in, the final recommendations in, and I, you know, I would ask you but also ask others in the audience who are experienced on this, that the staff would then draft a PDP process as opposed to a working group drafting a PDP process. I just was looking for clarification on that.
Yeah, actually the initial idea was to have already something, you know, we've already been talking to legal counsel to do something for this report, but because of the short time frame and we still had discussions quite, you know, towards the end and, you know, the publication deadline, but the idea is to already, you know, take once we have the public comments and this report back to legal counsel, work with them on, you know, building that language, taking that back to the work team just to say, look, does this match what, you know, you actually recommended, and have that as one package than to hand on to the PPSC and going forward.
Yeah, I think one of the points Marika was raising, that there are some holes in this report, and to the extent that those holes seem significant enough when we do have recommendations, and it may not be called a draft final report, it may be just an interim report on some of those items. I mean, there's options that we could do to get community feedback on those items that we have not yet addressed. So I want to thank everyone for attending the session, and I'm sure there's another one following it that we probably have gone over into. Oh, they actually had a break? Okay, good. So the next session here starts at 4. I don't know what it is, but I see Carla. So my guess is that it's about new TLDs. Just a guess. I guess we could stop the recording now. So thank you, everyone.